We'll hear argument first this morning in number 86805, Billy B.J. Pinter versus Maurice Dahl. Mr. Sparks, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The case this morning is important because it bears upon the day-to-day regulation of the securities industry. It has to do with two issues that concern Section 12.1 of the Securities Act of 1933, which provides for an express private right of action against any person who offers or sells an unregistered security through the use of the mails or the interstate commerce. I'd like to state the questions as follows. First of all, whether the long-established definition of a Section 12.1 seller under the Securities Act of 1933 and Section 12.1 specifically should be modified to incorporate a new threshold requirement that the seller must be motivated, and I would like to stress that word motivated, by a desire to receive a financial benefit for his efforts in order to be held responsible for his conduct. And secondly, whether or not the common law in peri delicto defense, or I would perhaps prefer to refer to this as the regulatory purpose defense rather than strict in peri delicto defense, is available in a private action for rescission of the sale of unregistered securities brought under Section 12.1. Just briefly, the statute provides that any person who offers or sells a security in violation of Section 77E of this title shall be liable to the person purchasing such security from him, and it goes on to provide for rescission in the common law fashion. To telegraph my position in this case, the Fifth Circuit's addition of a pecuniary benefits test to the settled definition of a seller of unregistered securities is damaging and threatening to the continued regulation of the securities industry, in my opinion, and the ruling by the Court of Appeals that the in peri delicto defense does not apply between co-violators of Section 12.1 is in direct conflict with this Court's ruling in the Bateman-Eichler case. I think the facts in this case are extremely important, and I would like to spend a certain amount of time with regard to the facts. Of course, in the trial court, Mr. Pinter, and he does pronounce his name that way, was a defendant. Mr. Dahl was one of 12 plaintiffs. Mr. Dahl and the other 11 plaintiffs sought to recover from Mr. Pinter for the sale of unregistered securities. The complaint detailed a number of misrepresentations and concealments and nondisclosures on the part of Mr. Pinter doing business under the various names of his companies. Mr. Dahl, the trial court found, was a California or Texas resident, a real estate broker, a man whose personal wealth exceeded $1 million, whose income approached $250,000 on an annual basis. And he detailed certain abortive efforts, and I'm at paragraph 7 on page 31 of the petition, the appendix to the petition for writ of certiorari. The trial court detailed certain abortive efforts by Mr. Dahl to become interested in the oil business. I would like to quote from the record. I want to make it clear that everything that I quote from the record will be from either Mr. Dahl's testimony, who I'm in opposition to, or from the testimony of Mr. Gotch, who was a witness called on behalf of Mr. Dahl. I'm not attempting to support my arguments by any statements made by my client in this case. Mr. Dahl testified at the appendix, joint appendix, page 105, that he was interested in being in the drilling business, that he did not have the money that he needed to become involved in the business, that he hired Mr. Miner, whose position was to raise money, and that's a quote, and that it was his job, and this is Mr. Miner, who was hired by Mr. Dahl to work for Puma Petroleum and Wrangler Oil and Gas. It was his job to bring investor money, and Mr. Miner was fired by Mr. Dahl prior to his hiring of a Mr. Kirk when it became known to Mr. Dahl that he had spent $10,000 to obtain a legal prospectus, and he was fired for that basis. And Mr. Dahl then hired another individual by the name of Mr. Kirk, who was in the Texas and Oklahoma area attempting to acquire leases for Mr. Dahl, who was living in California.
Was the legal prospectus the one that would have pertained to the transaction that gave rise to this suit?
The record doesn't say, Your Honor. It simply says
that... Do you contend that it was?
Sir?
Is that your... Are we supposed to draw that inference from your, what you're telling us?
The only inference that I would like the court to draw is that Mr. Dahl was aware of the need to draw a prospectus in becoming involved in the oil and gas business and had hired Mr. Miner for that purpose and fired him when he discovered that he'd spent $10,000 in that way. The position of the government, the Attorney General, is that one must be a promoter if one is interested in becoming involved in the business, more a promoter than an investor. One may be held in peri delicto. And I want to point out that, that I'm trying to isolate in my discussion of the facts those facts which would show that Mr. Dahl was desirous of getting into the oil and gas business and that it was his intention to not be merely an investor, at least initially. I think the inference that I've explained is all that needs to be drawn from that fact. Mr. Kirk was hired after Mr. Miner was fired. His job, this is page 108 from the Joint Appendix, was to locate, acquire, and sell leases. And Mr. Kirk introduced Mr. Dahl to Mr. Piner as a knowledgeable and capable oil man. I'd like to point out that Mr. Kirk, of course, was Mr. Dahl's agent in that introduction. And
he introduced him to his former employee.
Mr. Kirk, the new employee, introduced Mr. Dahl, his employer, to Mr. Piner, an oil man who was in the Oklahoma oil and gas business.
Oh, I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying Piner had previously worked for Dahl.
No, sir.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your statement as well as I should have.
Mr. Kirk was working for Mr. Dahl. He found Mr. Piner in Oklahoma, introduced Mr. Piner to Mr. Dahl as a knowledgeable oil and gas man who was working in Oklahoma. Then Mr. Piner came to Oklahoma, visited the properties, looked at the geology, the well logs, and the other materials which were assembled, in the words of the trial court, by Mr. Piner. And after conducting his own investigation of the circumstances, decided in the trial court's words that there was no way he could lose in investing. Now, there were two different groups of investments which were made by Mr. Dahl, and I would like to point this out, go into some detail here, because, again, it's important because it deals with Mr. Dahl's involvement and the extent to which he may be considered to be actively involved in seeking oil and gas business opportunities. After deciding that he wanted to invest with Mr. Piner, he went up to Kansas where he found his friend, a Mr. Gotch, who testified for him at the time of trial. Mr. Gotch was in the cattle feeding business, was an independently wealthy individual. He brought Mr. Gotch, contacted Mr. Gotch in his own words, brought Mr. Gotch to Oklahoma, introduced Mr. Gotch to Mr. Piner in Oklahoma, and as a result of that introduction, caused Mr. Gotch to loan him, Mr. Dahl, $250,000 and to put $250,000 of his own money into the initial three-well project that the two men got involved in. And they, Mr. Dahl and his friend, Mr. Gotch from Kansas, put up the entire $500,000 needed to fund the first three of five wells that will be discussed here. They bought all of the available interest money in those three wells. Mr. Dahl put not one penny of his own money into those three wells. He caused Mr. Gotch to loan him the money and solicited, I believe it's very fair to say, Mr. Gotch with regard to that transaction. Mr. Gotch and Mr. Dahl then went into business with Mr. Piner, in effect, drilling the first three wells. Sometime prior to that, Mr. Piner had begun the process of drilling two additional wells. In the words of Mr. Dahl, he decided that it would be appropriate for him to go to Mr. Piner and to suggest to Mr. Piner that he had certain friends and relatives in California who would be very interested in these other two wells, since they seemed like a sure deal as far as he was concerned. And so he went to Mr. Piner and suggested to Mr. Piner that he would involve his friends in California. Piner gave him some investment contracts. He took the investment contracts in hand, some of which were in blank, and some of which were made out in the name of Maurice Dahl or assignee. He then took these. They had not been fractionalized. They were simply blank investment contracts. Took them to California, went to 11 of his friends, sold them interests, made all representations, all communications to each of the people in California.
You say blank investment contracts, Mr. Sparks. Do you mean that the contracts were all written out but unsigned?
No, sir. They had blanks in them for the percentage of interest that the investor would buy. They had a blank for the name of the investor, or in some cases, instead of a blank, they said Maurice Dahl or assignee. So they were blank only in those respects, as to the amount of money, as to the percentage of interest in the various wells, and as to the person who was acquiring an interest.
You interrupted, Mr. Sparks.
Yes, sir.
Was this transaction with Mr. Gotch, the first half that you described, was Gotch one of the plaintiffs?
No, sir. He did not sue. He testified on behalf of Mr. Dahl, but he was not a plaintiff in the action. He testified at trial that he was looking, to put it in his words, and this is at 113 in the joint appendix, I was looking to Maurice. Whoever he was in business with, that was not of merit to me.
What's that got to do with the claims of the 11 other people?
The only importance Mr. Gotch has is that I believe it is very fair to say that Mr. Dahl solicited Mr. Gotch.
Maybe he solicited a lot of people, but they're not the people that are involved in the lawsuit. How does that bear on the lawsuit?
Well, it is, to me, sir, it's circumstantial evidence of Mr. Dahl's solicitor-type behavior. And it seems to me that it's fundamental to Section 12.1 of the Securities Act of 1933, especially when understood well on its face and also from the legislative history of that act. President Roosevelt's comments when he introduced the bill and asked that it be passed, that the whole idea was to shift the burden of responsibility on the person who made solicitive types of comments on representational activity.
Maybe he did or did not solicit the 11 people involved, but would it prove solicitation of these 11 that he solicited Mr. X, Y, and Z? I don't follow that.
No, sir, but in peri delicto is a type of actually what I refer to as the regulatory purpose defense. The whole issue is to look at what Mr. Dahl did.
Supposing you proved that he committed an egregious violation with respect to Mr. Gotch, would that be a defense that Mr. Pinter could assert in the claim?
It would be evidentiary of his conduct in peri delicto, yes, sir. I might point out, Justice Stevens, that at the trial court, Mr. Dahl was bore down exceedingly hard in attempting to establish that all of these transactions were integrated. Now, on appeal, the position is that these are separate transactions. But at trial, and I might point out also that the trial court found that each of the sales involved from the defendant to the various plaintiffs, including Mr. Dahl, were related. That was the word that the trial court used in describing the various oil wells and investments. Now, Mr. Gotch's involvement is simply circumstantial evidence of Mr. Dahl's attempt to solicit others in the offer, sale, and delivery of unregistered securities. The statute being a strict liability statute, clearly Mr. Pinter is responsible under Section 12.1. It's never contended otherwise. His position is to allow the judgment to be affirmed with regard to the other 11 plaintiffs, but with respect and solely with respect to Mr. Dahl. He is asserting the defense that it would be inappropriate and would not further the statutory purpose to allow Mr. Dahl to recover against him, because Mr. Dahl was fundamentally responsible in the words of the... Yes, sir.
May I ask you, you're only claiming pari delicto insofar as the claim by Dahl against...
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're not claiming that has any bearing on the claims of the 11, other 11 or a right to contribution or anything like that?
We did not appeal with regard to 12.1 violations as to the others. We do contend that Mr. Dahl should be responsible in contribution along with Mr. Pinter to the other 11 plaintiffs.
What is the statutory basis, or is it a state law basis, for your contribution claim?
The securities laws, Your Honor, Section 11, for example, provides for a right of contribution between joint tortfeasors.
That's because he's a seller?
Yes,
sir. He's a seller, and therefore a joint tortfeasor with Pinter.
That's correct, yes, Your Honor. Equally responsible for the same statutory violation.
And the Court of Appeals rejected your claim that he was a seller.
Yes, sir. They invoked a pecuniary benefit test to get around from my position, in order to substantiate the decision that he was not a seller.
And both issues are here.
Yes, sir. And the Court of Appeals found that he was that his conduct was a substantial factor in the sale of unregistered securities.
But what?
But that he was not motivated by a desire for pecuniary benefit, directly or indirectly, which seems to me to fall right in the face of the Dirks opinion, which talks about reputational benefit at the very least, and which seems to me on the facts, even the facts as adduced by the Fifth Circuit, to be inappropriate as a conclusion, as a matter of factual conclusion, Your Honor. This was a man who was trying to get into the business, who was also trying, in the words of Judge Brown, to capitalize his own investment, and thought it appropriate to do so by going to California and selling other investors in this very same project. It seems to me to be inappropriate to conclude that he was acting without, merely gregariously, is what the Fifth Circuit said. I don't believe that this was, in the words of Judge Jones, a happy hour cocktail conversationalist type of advice. This wasn't simply a comment. And in the words of the government, they contend that strongly urging someone to become involved without being motivated by pecuniary benefit constitutes non-seller, non-solicitation conduct. I would respectfully disagree with that position. It seems to me that fundamental to the Securities Act of 1933 is this concept that the burden must be shifted, and I am essentially quoting from the legislative history, House Report 85. Every lawyer knows that with all facts in control of the defendant, it is practically impossible for a buyer to prove a state of knowledge or a failure to exercise due care on the part of a defendant. How are you going to show what the motivation was in the mind of someone who is selling a security? It's going to get from a trial lawyer's standpoint, from a litigation standpoint, into a swearing match. And I think unnecessarily in protract litigation to have a test like that. Unless responsibility, I'm quoting now from H.R. 85, 1933, is to involve merely paper liability, it is necessary to throw the burden of disproving responsibility for reprehensible acts of omission or commission on those who purport to issue statements. It seems to me that the gravamen of the wrong, if you will, the statutory wrong, is to sell. You can't go to California with a bunch of investment contracts in your briefcase and sit down with your friends, including your banker and a man who's in the contracting business with you, and your accountant, and your partner in a business deal, and your employer and employees. And these were the individuals that from the record and from Mr. Dahl's testimony, were the people who purchased, none of whom knew each other in the admission of the respondent prior to Mr. Dahl's selling them. You can't go to those people, those kinds of people, sit there with an investment contract and fill out the blanks without assuming some fiduciary responsibility, it seems to me, to them to tell them the truth. Now Mr. Dahl's position is, I'm not a seller. That seems to me to be absurd. He is a seller, and the mere fact that he is not directly receiving some pecuniary benefit doesn't mean that he's not receiving some pecuniary benefit. Certainly he is, because he's capitalizing the investment that he's trying to become involved in.
Mr. Sparks, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but you told me that you're relying on Section 11 for the right of contribution. Isn't this a Section 12 suit?
It's a Section 12 lawsuit from the standpoint of the plaintiff.
Then Section 11 applies to misstatements and prospectuses, doesn't it?
Applies to...
Section 12 is where you have no registration at all, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
So the contribution right doesn't apply to this case, does it?
I believe it does, Your Honor. And I've addressed that in my brief, and I do believe that there is a right of contribution under common law.
Has any court so held under a Section 12 case?
No, Your Honor, no court is so held in a Section 12 case. And I might point out that I do believe that that issue has been perfected, because I attempted at the time of trial to have Mr. Dahl realigned as a third-party defendant from the outset, and the trial court refused to realign him as a third-party defendant. And I was not able to assert a contribution defense at that time. It was submitted to a magistrate. Appealed that, and it was overruled by operation of law.
Of course, Mr. Sparks, I thought that both the District Court and the Fifth Circuit determined that Mr. Dahl lacked any sort of pecuniary gain motivation.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. What The trial court found was that Mr. Dahl did not receive a commission from the sale of unregistered securities. The trial court did not enter a finding with respect to direct or indirect pecuniary benefit. And the Fifth Circuit decided that he was merely gregarious. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Toronto.
Chief Justice Rehnquist, and may it please the Court. On the in pari delicto question in this case, the Securities and Exchange Commission thinks that the Court of Appeals was wrong to the extent it ruled that the in pari delicto defense is never available in an action brought under Section 12(1). As I propose to explain in more detail in a moment, and I want to present our views in a manner slightly different from our presentation in our brief, we think the in pari delicto defense should be available in certain narrowly defined circumstances. On the second question in the case, we think that the Court of Appeals was right in ruling that a person who solicits a securities purchase may be liable under Section 12(1) along with the person who passed title, but only if the solicitor had some motivation in promoting the purchase other than a friendly desire to further the interests of the buyer, because only then can he fairly be aligned on the selling side of the transaction. We do not take a position in this case on whether contribution may be available in a Section 12 action.
Mr. Toronto, suppose the primary defendant here, suppose Mr. Pinter, were a philanthropist, and it were shown that he really didn't expect to make any profit from this stock, but just to benefit his friends and associates, he was selling these interests in the Wells. Would that be enough to exempt him from liability under 12(1)?
No, I don't think so. Not when the issuer is actually the person passing title to the security.
But he comes under the same language. I mean, his sells or offers. Why should that be a necessity for the in pari delicto defense, but not a necessity for the substantive liability in the first place?
Well, we don't think that the financial interest test does not go to the in pari delicto defense. It goes only to whether a person other than the person passing title can also be a seller and therefore conceivably liable to the other people that he solicited.
I understand that, but that's the first step to establishing the in pari delicto defense. Why should it be that the issuer need not have that kind of motivation, but someone else, in order to be liable, must?
Somebody other than the — we think that Section 12 is firmly rooted in the common law remedy of rescission, where financial interest doesn't play a role as to the person who passes title. The history of the development of Section 12 and its amendment in 1954 and its judicial history prior to that seems to us to make it clear that liability can extend somewhat beyond the person who owned the security before the sale. The question then is what kind of limits have to be placed on the extension of liability beyond the person who passed title. Solicitation, we think, is part of the statute, but there is an important distinction, which we think the Court of Appeals rightly captured, between somebody who simply urges somebody else to get in on a good deal, and on the other hand, somebody who, because of his own interest, is properly aligned on the selling side of the transaction. We don't think financial benefit we don't mean by that something terribly precise or limited, in that indirect financial interest can align the individual on the selling side of the transaction, just as a commission can.
But that's not necessary, you say, to align Pinter on the selling side.
No, it seems to me there are always two people on each of the two, one person on each of the two sides of a sale, the person who passed title, the person who then owns the security after the transaction. And what we're trying to do is to establish some limits on the extension of the seller class beyond the person who is unquestionably in that class, namely the person who passed title.
That's
the key then. If you have title and pass it, it doesn't matter whether your motivation is beneficent or profit. Whereas if you didn't pass title and you're sucked in only as someone who participated in the offering somehow, you need the motivation.
Yes, I think that's right.
Somebody else.
If you're an agent for the seller, there is very likely to be some kind of interest of your own, presumably a continuing relationship with the seller, if you're carrying on the activity for the seller.
Suppose the person holding title is an agent of someone else, just for the purpose of holding title, and he passes it when he's told to by his principal.
It sounds to me as though, at least I'm somewhat confused about who exactly is passing title in the course of that.
Whoever is holding title passes title, and suppose the person holding title is an agent for that purpose for somebody else.
I think anybody who is the holder of title before is a seller. Right. That's right. Let me try to.
Can I ask one other question about the seller? Is it necessary to be a seller in order to? I mean, is it not possible that Dahl could not be a seller and nevertheless the defense of in pari delicto would be available?
Oh, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
And is it also not possible that he could be a seller and nevertheless the claim of contribution would fail?
Yes.
So that it may be true that we don't have to decide the seller issue.
That's right. The Court of Appeals did not decide the underlying legal question whether contribution can ever be available in Section 12. It found it unnecessary to do that because it thought contribution shouldn't be available in this case, right, even if it could be available in some other Section 12 case.
Do you also think, Mr. Toronto, that the District Court and the Fifth Circuit did not make the necessary determination about the pecuniary interest that Dahl might have had?
Yes, we do. We think the District Court did note that Dahl did not receive any commissions, but did not address whether there were some indirect financial interest, in particular whether Dahl would have needed these particular purchases in order to make his investment profitable, whether there were other potential purchasers who might have taken the place of these.
So you think we need to remand on that?
Yes, we do.
And that means we have to also address the merits of the contribution issue?
Well, it seems to us that that issue has not been briefed, and if on remanding to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals were to address the contribution question and decide that contribution could not be available under Section 12 regardless of the particular financial interest or its absence, then that issue would not have to be addressed. But the question whether Section 12 in any circumstance permits contribution has not been presented or briefed in this case. So that issue would have to be decided on remand.
Mr. Toronto, will you do one more thing because your time is short? Will you be sure and you explain to me the difference between the position you now advocate and the one you set forth in your brief? Because I want to be sure I get that there.
The difference, I think, is really one of emphasis. To the extent that we suggested in the brief that the first part of our test for the in pari delicto defense was that the buyer had to be more of a promoter than an investor. The main thing I wanted to do was to dispel any misimpression that what we meant by that was a simple comparison. How much did the buyer solicit? How much did he purchase? And that would somehow automatically answer the question. By promoter, we mean something broader than that. We mean simply what role did this buyer play in the offering as a whole. To be a promoter, he might have played an active role in any number of respects, not just soliciting purchases. He might have prepared offering material. He might have been the instigator.
And not necessarily to these particular plaintiffs.
That's right. We think that what we mean by the promoter part of the test is something that focuses on the buyer's role in the offer as a whole. We then move on.
But you wouldn't say in the colloquy that was going on with between counsel and Justice Stevens that the offering to someone who was not one of the plaintiffs here is merely confirmatory or circumstantial evidence of the necessary qualification.
We think that could be evidence of
direct evidence
of a promoter role.
May I ask one more question?
if I agree with you that this matter was not found, that is the financial motivation, by the district court, but I think it was found by the Court of Appeals, would we still have to remand? Your brief says the Court of Appeals didn't find it either. I happen to disagree with that. What if I think the Court of Appeals did find no financial motivation, but the district court didn't?
I think without factual findings by the district court made in the light of a broad enough understanding of what kinds of financial interests can qualify for this test to align him on the selling side of the transaction, that further findings should be made. I mean, in particular, there seems to have been some disagreement between the majority and the dissent in the Court of Appeals about certain kinds of indirect financial interests and whether they would qualify.
Mr. Toronto, I do take it that you disagree with the Court of Appeals on the standard to be applied in determining the in pero delicto defense.
Yes, we read the Court of Appeals to have said because 12.1 is a strict liability statute, the in pero delicto defense is never available.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toronto. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Spinuzzi.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. We have a delicate problem here in dealing with the securities laws. Congress set them up, this Court has interpreted them, and now we are juggling with those laws and taking them out of balance again. And the premise on which we're trying to take these delicate mechanisms out of balance is that this Court made a ruling in the Bateman-Eichler case that under certain circumstances, the defense of in pari delicto may be asserted in a 10b-5 fraud case. It is sought here to extend that beyond the fraud activity to a non-registered security activity. Frankly, my first impression was similar, that a strict liability statute, you could never bring in pari delicto. I don't agree with that now because equitably, it has always been permitted not only in fraudulent conduct, but also in illegal conduct. And if there is an illegal act in selling unregistered securities, then I agree with the SEC that in pari delicto should be applicable. However, it is a rare exception, as stated by this Court, that you will permit that defense, because the normal and general rule is it will not be permitted. Now, we have a special problem here. Section 12.1 specifically says that the seller will be liable to his purchaser for selling unregistered securities. There is no defense to that statement. It is absolute liability. In this particular case, Mr. Pinter was the seller of securities. He admitted it. The court found they were not registered. The court found him liable, not only to Mr. Dahl, but to Mr. Dahl's friends and associates who also invested. The critical nature of this problem is, can an illegal seller of unregistered securities avoid his liability by raising a theory that one of the buyers indirectly or directly assisted him in bringing other investors into the ventures? To me, that is a critical question. It's not quite a tippy-tip-or situation. As the Fifth Circuit stated, it was a gregarious act intended to benefit his friends. I'm talking about Mr. Dahl's friends. And to show how he tried to benefit them, it's critical for this Court to be aware that Mr. Dahl invested a total of $351,000, roughly, in three different ventures. His 10 or 11 friends that he brought in invested a total of $82,000 in two ventures. And more importantly, the other plaintiffs, we'll call them the California investors because that's essentially what they are except for one person who was Mr. Dahl's fiancé. The California investors invested in two wells And those wells and leases had already been fractionated by Mr. Pinter months and months before. He had already drilled two wells on one lease with other investors. He already drilled one well on another lease with other investors. He was trying to drill two more wells. We call them the DOS 3B well and the DOS 2C well. He had some of his investors drop out. When they dropped out, he approached Mr. Dahl and he said, "Mr. Dahl, some of my investors have fallen out. I've got room for some more." Dahl said, "Fine, I have some close friends. Probably will be interested. Let me check." And he did. In the DOS 3B, there were three investors from these plaintiffs. One was Mr. Dahl himself, one was his fiancée, and one was his CPA. Those three investors invested little. The CPA invested $7,400, his fiancée invested $3,500, and Mr. Dahl invested about $28,000. But the remainder, the several hundred thousand dollars that were raised by people unknown to Mr. Dahl and by Mr. Piner. He raised that capital. So the act of selling unregistered securities was already in process by Mr. Dahl, and all he did was get Mr. Piner, and all he did was get Mr. Dahl to help fill in the void for the last three interests. As to the Antoine 2C, the same basic idea, except a total of nine of Mr. Dahl's friends invested approximately $7,500 in those wells. And the remainder of the funds were raised by other investors, by Mr. Piner in his other efforts. Now, the record shows that Mr. Piner...
What did the Court of Appeals find on this point? It
made no finding whatsoever on that, except this.
Didn't its opinion assume, it seems to me, that didn't it appear to assume that he was a substantial factor in the whole
thing? Yes, sir, it was. And that substantial factor came up under the idea of how do you determine who and what is a seller. The statute does not define a seller.
I understand that, but so you're challenging the Court of Appeals...
No, I'm not challenging the Court of Appeals. I'm challenging their precedent, yes, because the majority refused to follow that precedent. They added the other financial benefit test as a threshold requirement. And frankly, I think rightly so, either that one or some other. And let me explain why, sir. We already have a complicated securities law. We now, in a strict liability section, statute where there is no defense, section 12.1, we suddenly throw in tort negligence law. And we not only throw in tort negligence law, we throw in one of the most complicated concepts that they have under that law. That is proximate cause, legal liability, and to determine proximate cause, they now say you must be a substantial factor. And I have cited in my brief what some of the authorities think of substantial factor. They say it's good for trying to determine causation in fact. But it has no bearing, has no relevance, and in fact is a hindrance to determining actual legal liability. That's a policy decision of this court and of Congress. It is not a decision for the court to be making at the trial level saying if a substantial cause or a substantial factor in causing it, then he's liable. It's sort of the old idea of, but for you introducing me to him, I never would have met him, I never would have sold him. Therefore, you are the substantial cause of my selling him. That's not a good standard. It is already a confusing issue in tort law, and here we are going to try and make it more confusing in the securities law.
I don't understand what you're saying. Are you saying that he's liable even if he's not a substantial factor?
Or I say,
if he is a substantial factor, he's not liable.
Mr. Stahl is not liable. Both the trial court and the Fifth Circuit found he was not. Mr. Piner was because he was the issuer of the securities.
What would make Dahl liable in your view?
In my view,
the actual seller who transfers title?
That would be one, because by all case law, that would do it.
I'm sure that would. What else?
I think there's other situations. Let me use an example. If Mr. Dahl knew that these were unregistered securities, which he did, and he knew that there was a private offering exemption being sought to be proven, and Mr. Dahl himself knew that he could avoid and ruin the private offering exemption by his own wrongful conduct, then I think he could be liable. A person who wants to meet the private offering exemption or the non-public offering exemption, as it's technically called, has certain restrictions. Section 4.2 is the exemption provided by Congress to say, all right, if you don't want to sell registered securities, you can sell unregistered securities on condition that you make the proper disclosures.
And that's the only thing that the language offers or sells, that the phrase, that the word offers beyond the transfer of title.
It doesn't really quite say that either. Section 12.1 says, whoever offers or sells a security in violation of Section 5 shall be liable to his seller. Or his purchaser, excuse me, I said seller. The seller is liable to the purchaser, but it doesn't say whoever violates the statute.
And the offerer is liable to nobody.
It doesn't say that specifically in the statute, no. It would be construed, and I think in many instances it can, because the consummation of the sale appears to be the actual damage, not necessarily just the offer. It's an interesting point because at one time the statute in the definition included sale to include an offer. It was later amended about 1958 and removed that provision. But logically speaking, a person who really actively participates in the sale, and I think a pecuniary benefit test is applicable because, very frankly, in the trial court, the defense was raised that Mr. Dahl agreed to sell in exchange for a commission. That's a pecuniary benefit. It was disproved, and it was finally admitted by Mr. Pinter that he was wrong, that he did not pay a commission or agree to pay a commission. So that would be one sense. Another sense would be the way the SEC has taken the position. That is, if he was a promoter of the enterprise, he had a financial interest in the actual business himself, that'd be different. We have taken the position that where the purchaser of a security has only an interest in a venture as an investor himself, he cannot be a seller to someone else merely by saying, hey, I've got a good deal, I've checked it out, I think it's great, you ought to get into it. And that's basically what happened here. Now, there wasn't even any negotiation by Mr. Dahl with these other people. The subscription agreement prepared by Mr. Pinter and given to Mr. Dahl has all the terms and the conditions of the sale. The only thing it lacked was the name of the investor, his social security number, his address, and at the very end it has a form of schedule which says if you buy a 1/16th interest it costs you X dollars, if you buy 3/64ths it costs you X dollars. All you do is take it from this part of the subscription. Yes, sir.
What is Mr. Dahl's account of why he did all this? Just to get his friends in on this good deal?
Yes, sir. It really was. As a matter of fact, to understand why he did, these were all people he had known for some time. They were his business partners, his banker. He used to be in the construction business. His banker, his insurance man, his fiance, his own brother. There wasn't any stranger to him that he was not a close associate with that he didn't say, hey, you ought to get in on this. He received nothing but perhaps, hopefully, the friendship was increased. I don't know what else. You may be right. What really bothers me is the attempt here to shift the burden of what I consider the statute's main function, disclosure of all material information in connection with an investment opportunity. Mr. Pinter says, hey, you should have told him the truth. Now, the critical thing that came up in the testimony that really is shocking is Mr. Pinter says that he gave nothing to Mr. Dahl to explain this offering. Or the three offerings. Nothing. He gave him one thing as a kind of a geological report, but it had nothing to do with the particular well. He just said it was just to give him an idea of approximately where the wells were located. Well, that doesn't even meet, of course, the registration requirements, and certainly does not meet the exemption requirements. And in this regard, Mr. Pinter specifically said in his subscription agreement, these securities are not registered under the Securities Act of 1903. But then it goes on, in reliance upon Rule 146. And Rule 146 is a specific SEC rule providing a safe haven for an offering which is exempt from registration under the non-public offering exemption of Section 4.2. Now, if you're going to put the burden on Mr. Dahl and say, equitably, he's estopped, he's in pari delicto because he knew the securities were unregistered, so did everyone else who invested those wells because they all signed the subscription agreement, and the subscription agreement is very specific. These are not registered. But if you're going to charge him with that burden, then we should always charge him with the other burden that says, in reliance upon Rule 146, meaning that Mr. Piner must have complied with Rule 146. But the testimony was just the opposite. Mr. Dahl, and this is interesting. Mr. Dahl received a financial statement.
But the others aren't responsible for its having failed to be a private offering. And the contention here is that Dahl is, in part, because he was one of those who promoted the entire scheme, whether he did it for purposes of friendship or for purposes of profit.
Disagree. For this reason. The scheme, as you call it, had already been laid and in existence and in operation. This is basically what the SEC wants to find out. Was Dahl personally involved in the scheme as a promoter? It was already in operation. They were selling the interest to other people. He only needed a few more people to fill out and finalize his subscriptions.
So you say if someone else has already approached enough other people that the private offering exemption is lost, has already been lost, then someone who comes in at that stage and assists in selling it to even more of the public, he's okay because, after all, the violation has already occurred.
No, sir.
Is that your theory?
No, sir. If that person comes in as an agent for the seller, I'm talking about the issuer as a seller, he should be liable also. But that's basically held by the courts anyway. If he is the agent selling on behalf of the issuer, there is another one that goes where if he's in a control relationship with the issuer, Section 15, I believe it is, there's a specific liability which they can take him up. Why do we have to go to the inquiry?
But not if he's doing it for his own financial gain.
He is not.
No, but what if he's doing it for his own financial gain?
In that case, I would say he's going to come under the three categories of either an issuer or an underwriter or a dealer in securities. Those definitions are broad enough to catch a person in that position. As a matter of fact, one of the exemptions from registration specifically says, if you're not an issuer, if you're not an underwriter, or not a dealer, you may sell the securities. Now, normally that's a secondary trading type exemption, but it could also count for a normal issue. So, in those three categories, I think it would almost always lump them in. And interestingly enough, that came up after the trial in a proposed finding of fact, but it was 2 weeks after the trial, and it was not ruled on by the court, and I can understand. And there's something else about the trial court. I have put in my brief, as far as I'm concerned, these issues are not even properly before this court. We do not think that the impari delicto defense or the estoppel defense or the right of contribution were ever raised in the trial court in the form in which they're being brought here. In the form they're being brought here is with reference to the sale of unregistered securities. The manner in which it was raised in the trial court was under a 10b-5 fraud theory. Well, excuse me, I'll take it back. It was under a common law fraud theory that Mr. Dahl made material misrepresentations and omissions of fact that caused Mr. Piner to engage in this wrongful conduct.
The Fifth Circuit passed upon the impari delicto.
Fifth Circuit apparently decided it was significant enough importance that they would go ahead and rule on it.
And the estoppel.
As a matter of fact, estoppel was the main point of Judge Hill. Judge Hill kept saying, estoppel, of course, here was he knew or did not know that securities were unregistered. Judge Hill said, so what? The old case from the Fifth Circuit, Henderson versus Hayden, they've always applied the standard that you cannot waive your rights under the statute and you can't be estopped from your rights under the statute, even if you have knowledge that they're unregistered. Because in this instance, the great white father Congress says we're going to protect you, public, from your own ignorance, unless the issuer gives you complete disclosure of all material information. If he gives you disclosure, then you, Mr. Investor, it's your tough luck. You take care of yourself. And that's the way it has been, and really the way it should be, because the law imparts the fairness of disclosing the investment opportunity.
Well, Mr. Spinosi, it seems to me that under that approach that it would further Congress's objectives to provide an impari delicto defense to someone who is a promoter and who gets other people to buy these unregistered securities as a promoter, and I think that's what the SEC is arguing.
I think they're trying to well, SEC has policy decisions, too, and I agree. And their policy decision is here is they would like to enlarge it to cover a promoter in that sense, and I can't
and
disagree.
And it would seem to further Congress's purposes.
Yes.
So the question is whether Mr. Dahl is indeed a promoter in that sense.
I agree, and I will...
Perhaps the courts below didn't have a chance to focus on that because at least the Fifth Circuit thought that defense wasn't available at all.
I don't think that's the reason, but they did not focus, but the reason is it was never made an issue in the trial court. But more importantly, even if it had been, the record in the trial court shows absolutely no evidence to support such a theory. So assuming a remand is an example, there's nothing there in the record for the court to make a ruling on. There is nothing, absolutely zero, to indicate that Mr. Dahl was a promoter of this, evidentiary-wise, otherwise. That would mean that we start a trial all over again on issues that, in my opinion, were never raised.
Do you accept the I don't think you accept the SEC's definition of the in pari delicto defense? Do you think it requires the person asserting it to be a does it require Dahl to be a promoter?
I think that it would. That would be. You see, I'm afraid to say.
Well, that's something different than we said in the Eichler case.
Yes, sir.
That's an additional element that's not present in Eichler.
That is correct.
But Eichler referred to another section. Is that it?
Eichler was basically talked under the 1934 Act, which was a 10b-5 fraud action, and we're not talking about fraud here. I can understand the exception that this court made in the Eichler case. It makes good sense. But, you know, in that case, even the court here did not permit the impari delicto defense to be used.
Exactly. Well, why do you need any more in this case?
I don't think we need any more. But, you see, the wrongful conduct they're claiming that Mr. Dahl is that he was also a seller to his friends by giving them a tip.
And so what if we say that the impari delicto defense is available in some circumstances, contrary to the Court of Appeals, must we not remand and say, look, here's the right rule, now decide whether it's available on the facts? If there aren't enough facts, maybe you have to send it back to the trial court.
I do disagree with the SEC on that part. I don't believe the Fifth Circuit said that the impari delicto defense was never permissible in a Section 12.1 strict liability situation.
Well, it said it wasn't available here.
Yes, sir, it did. In this case. And the reason it did is said that Dahl is a buyer of all these securities. And as a buyer, you're talking about so-called seller activity, which is a matter not related to his own purchases. That is basically what the court said, that if you're going to use the equitable defense of impari delicto, it must relate to the same identical matter of which you complain. Mr. Dahl was not complaining about the wrongful sales to his friends. He was complaining about the wrongful sales to him.
Absent a showing that Dahl's conduct was offensive to the dictates of natural justice, the unclean hands, the impari delicto and unclean hands are not available.
I agree, and the only thing I can figure there is he's going back to the historical, call it transition of the equitable doctrine.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals hold in discussing estoppel, that to allow the estoppel defense would frustrate the purposes of the Act?
Yes, sir.
And well, that's one of the requirements also of impari delicto under Eichler.
They have a slightly different wording, sir, if I may read my note here on it. Under the Eichler case, it says a preclusion of suit would not significantly interfere with effective enforcement or protection of the public. The Henderson standard says it would further the goals of securities. To me, they're basically the same, but they're slightly different wording, and apparently Judge Brown in his dissent put some emphasis on that difference.
Yeah, but it says, the opinion says that would frustrate the purposes of the Securities Act.
That's correct.
Isn't that Eichler, too?
Yes, in my opinion, yes. The word is slightly different, but I see nothing different whatsoever in substance. In addition, the Henderson case was really primarily directed in its application by the Fifth Circuit at the estoppel theory, that his knowledge that the securities were unregistered, that the court said, in its opinion, the Eichler case still applies to the estoppel theory as to knowledge of unregistered securities, but that in any event, in the majority's view, even if you apply the Eichler standard, it still would not bar or preclude recovery by Mr. Dahl. I have nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you very much, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Spinuzzi. Mr. Sparks, you have 1 minute remaining.
May it please the Court. I would like to address a couple of questions very quickly. As to the disclosure issue, counsel has argued, I submit outside the record, that there were omissions. The trial court found that there were no violations of 10b-5, no omissions and no acts that constituted a violation of Section 10b-5 in paragraph 25 of the court's findings. Secondly, I would like to point out in response to the questions of Justices Scalia and White, with regard to the in peri delicto test suggested by the government, they suggest that one ought to be a promoter and somehow be involved in the decision not to register or involved in the conduct that results in the loss of the exemption. And I submit that in a 12-1 context, strict liability context, this puts again the burden on establishing a state of mind that a decision was made not to register, that a decision was made to take the transaction outside the exemptions. I submit that that, again, flies in the face of the basis of the statute. Secondly, in response to Justice Scalia's questioning concerning the substantial factor test, there is some confusion.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.